Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. June is Immigrant Heritage Month, and we are celebrating all month long by sharing past programs presented in conjunction with our special exhibit, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. This exhibit has been extended through 2021, and you can explore it in person at the American Writers Museum or online at my-america.org. This week, we talk with poet Khaled Matawa about his recent collection, Fugitive Atlas, a sweeping, impassioned collection of poems that touches on the themes of immigration, occupation, environmental destruction, and more. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
We're grateful to all of you for being here and for valuing the past, present, and future of American writing. My name is Allison Sansoni, and I'm the program director here at the museum. This program is the latest in the Jean and John Rowe program series, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. It's presented in conjunction with the exhibit of the same name, which can be viewed at our museum on Michigan Avenue in Chicago, or online at my-america.org. The exhibit and series honors the contributions to American writing from those Americans who came here or whose ancestors came here from worlds away. Tonight, we're joined by poet, writer, and translator Khaled Matawa, whose newest collection of poems, Fugitive Atlas, charts the world's refugee crisis, ecological degradation, and military occupations through the lives of those within that upheaval, offering humanity and hope in exploring their voices and dreams. He is a MacArthur Fellow and the author of four collections of poetry, including Tocqueville, and is the translator of 9 books of contemporary Arabic poetry, including Saadi Yusuf's Without an Alphabet, Without a Face. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you for being here with us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me. Glad to be here.
I wanted to start by talking a little bit about your new book and the idea of an atlas and the place it describes. How did you settle on this image for your collection?
It's very interesting. I mean, the idea of the book being a large scope, a book covering, you know, a period of time, concerns, large topics, places, was always in the manuscript, but it wasn't the original title. I thought of something called the Book of Something. It was the Book of Difficult Times or whatever. But it wasn't like one topic that you could give it a title and you'll be there. It seemed to need an idea of an emphatically self-conscious book, or that's broad. And so Atlas was something to settle on because of the variety of places and the variety of difficulties encountered. And I think it referenced to movement. And when you think of a lot of, you know, the difficulties people are facing have a lot to do with limited movement, inability to access resources or to move on from a part of the world which has run out of water or the ground is no longer arable or whatever. So it's it's come from that need to of direction, but also it's become a sort of a chronicle of the difficulties that one encounters when flight is the course that one ends up taking. So Atlas is a fugitive's atlas, if you can think of the title that way. It's also a sense of a shifting atlas, because the word fugitive also comes from watercolors, and watercolors that kind of bleed into other colors and get fogged up and so on are called fugitive colors. So all of these kind of worked with the idea of a blurred sense of destination, the need to look up the landscape and to try to find your way anyway. And the fact that it's a muddled world, and so the cover kind of takes care of that, at least visually, even though the color, the cover is actually a real picture from a satellite dish. It's not a fake painting or anything. It is from up there, and it is a cloud pattern over the desert. I don't know how the color ended up being that way, but that's what it looked up from the satellite. So it seemed altogether perfect as an image, as a title, and an encapsulation of the book. The final thing is that one of my first reviewers of my book was a professor at Texas. She passed away a few years ago. Her name is Barbara Harlow, and she described my work, and this is the fifth book, not the fourth. She described my first book as a kind of a new cartography, in that I was sort of presenting a different route or landscape or territory that I was charting, given that I was also writing poems located in different places. So cartographer it is, and an atlas maker I will ever, well, forever be, I guess.
It's interesting that you talk about the satellite, the view from the satellite, because we, you know, those of us outside of a conflict tend to view it from above, you know, but you deliberately chose the voices of people directly affected by what we, you know, very airily call geopolitical forces. Yeah. Why did you choose to center those voices?
Maybe one of the great statements I've learned over the years, an encapsulation, maybe even a misquote, is grace is the gift of the other. This is from Bakhtin, the great Russian philosopher, literary critic. Grace is the gift of the other, that I have no self. Self is the grace of the other, a gift of the other. So in a sense, there is no self to be gifted to us or to be owned except from the other. The other aspect that Bakhtin also talks about is that we have excess seeing. We see more than we need to see. That there's a lot that we see that doesn't get incorporated into our lives as such. And this capacity to excessively see or to see more than we need is really sort of the provenance of empathy. We have more feelings to be had than we have for ourselves. When I see somebody hit by a car or shot or stabbed or even pricked by a pin or something, you could just feel like this sensation of feeling. So we have this ability to transcend our limitations and to feel what others feel, to feel for others, not exactly what they feel, but we can comprehend, and that's. That's for everyone. All of us are capable of that. But it becomes, it's also the business of writing. I mean, if you're a novelist and you write about 7 or 8 characters, you make them up from zero. You imagine all of them. If you're omniscient, if not, whatever it is, you're conceiving of all of these lives because of this excess of seeing and feeling. And so being a poet is not that different from being a novelist or a dramatist. And so if you're devoted to a subject or it moves you, then it's, then you just go into trying to what might this person be thinking? What might this person be thinking? And how could this be? And you pick with the people with you're sympathetic toward. And then you say, well, what about this person who traffics in this, and the person who imprisons people, and the person who maybe tortures or gets tortured? And it's not perfect. It's not even right. Maybe in the sense of you never get it quite right. but it's that ability to engage with situations, with personalities, with different experiences by learning more, that you could perhaps inhabit these spaces. So coming to the voices, it seemed to me like that was how you conveyed it, how you portrayed it, was to try to occupy as many positions knots of feeling as possible in order to understand. And those sounds are out there. And the journalists have done their work, the researchers have done their work in terms of conveying the facts. Then it becomes the artist or the poet or the dramatist to try to pull it together into a moving story, I hope.
Yeah. As a poet, do you choose the form first or do you choose the imagery?
I'm trained more towards the image. They sort of come together. I mean, I've never written a thin poem knowing that I'm going to write a thin poem first. It just seems like the thinness came with the content. I would say that, but it wasn't even that difficult because it was the writing happens in the middle. So maybe I would start writing a poem without wanting to write it in three-line stanzas. But once I've written a few lines and I take it into the computer and try to finish it and so on, then it begins to be shaped that way. So that the strategic formal decision in this piece was to write all the verse in three-line stanzas, in tercets. And as you can see, some of them are long and some of them are short. Some of them are skinny, some of them are wide. But everything was in three lines. There, you know, I can't really, that's probably as arbitrary a choice as I made in the book. I wanted to have a consistent stanza, perhaps to force a kind of an elementary or sort of a basic unity, a sense of unity that all of these are stamped with that three-line stanza. That's sort of like a kind of a DNA to all of these, to force them to be thought of together. Some of the stanzas end with a period, or the lines have end stops with a comma and so on, and some of them are in gem, but all of them are three. There are some haibuns or prose poems that have some verse at the bottom, and those two are done in a tercet or one kind or another. So so it comes together, but in this case, the shape of the stanza was one that was decided on before and helped shape the poems eventually.
The idea of searching for home runs, throughout your work. What is the place where you feel most at home? And has that changed for you over the years?
I think there is as much as a desire for that, as much as there is a kind of resistance. The desire is, yes, you want to be settled and comfortable wherever you are, to have a life of engagement, of happiness, of growth, of development, definitely. But at the same time, you would want to have the ability to move and to create community where you can do that. You don't want to have a situation where movement debilitates you. So it's as much the desire to be home or to find home or to find rest, but it's also the fact that this is the anxiety about why not have it? Why is it so difficult to belong, to feel at home, to contribute in some places? So I guess in some ways, it is something that both haunts my story, but also one that that I wanted to celebrate, because I've moved around and I've been able, learned after some time, to come back. I mean, it's and to create community and to be in multiple communities at the same time. Okay, digitally, maybe, of course, physically it's impossible, but you can stay with your friends in Libya and stay in touch with them. And those friends there in that same place are different from the community that's your family, from the ones that are in Egypt, from the ones that are scattered. So I think, you know, home ultimately is the place where you are happy, but also your place where you are doing the most good. It is a combination of virtue, self-fulfillment, that you are acting up to your own potential, and it's joy and happiness. And okay, there are people that are involved in political resistance and are struggling and that are fighting and so on, but these people are involved in virtue, and that makes them happy. Happiness is not, as much as I was envy my friends who are by the wonderful beaches wherever they are, happiness is not about just having a pina colada and being by the, you know, by the beach. It is, you know, feeling fulfilled psychologically, philosophically, if you will, spiritually. And sometimes that's not about relaxing. It's about really being engaged and being putting up effort towards improving life and community and even the environment, which is we are seeing all over as a highly polluted place that needs to be repaired. So, you know, wherever you are doing virtue and doing it in community, I think that's the place where home becomes, because it's the place of the psyche and the soul finding nourishment by giving it as well.
That's wonderful. I wanted to ask, what was your journey to the United States? What were the circumstances? And, you know, what was your first experience sort of writing in the U.S.?
The journey between coming and writing is also kind of long. You know, that's why I needed this atlas all the time. I needed to know where I was going. In fact, well, maybe writing is where I began to create an atlas, to tell you the truth. But I came to the United States at the age of 15. I had just finished in America. You would finish middle school, which is middle school in America is 8 years, but in Libya and the Middle East, it's the ninth year. And normally people either went to college after their college degree or after high school, but my family sort of expedited the process, partly because of the political circumstances in Libya. The schools were becoming just sort of somewhat dangerous, meaning that there was the militarized schools, the army was taking over schools, there were a lot of suspicion and oppression within the country. This is under Gaddafi's regime when he really controlled the country and grabbed all the reins of power. And it became a much more sort of idiosyncratic situation where you never knew when you're in danger or not and so forth. So my brother had gone to college here, and some cousins. Mississippi is where I landed in my first state in the United States. And so they said, well, why don't you join them? And this is goes back to an earlier tradition in my family where they were sending boys to finish high school in Egypt, because in some parts of Libya, I think in the 1940s, maybe there were only two operational high schools in the whole country after World War II. And World War II, people forget that World War II really you know, decimated my city, Benghazi, and other parts of Libya. So uncles had gone to Egypt to finish high school. It wasn't strange for the family. It was just a further place. But back then, people went to Egypt by car, and it took them 3 or 4 days to get there. And going to America by airplane may have not seemed all that far. So that was a tradition of diaspora or exile, education as something to be sought as distant as possible. If need be, you travel far for it, no problem. You got to go get it. So America was the place. The visas were easy. My brother was here. My older cousins were here. And then I studied English at a college to study English. But then I had to finish high school at a Catholic high school in Louisiana. And then I think college, the beginning of college was the beginning of wandering, really, because I didn't know what I wanted to study. I didn't know what whether to actually study or just to read the books that I loved. I sort of meandered for a few years, managed to keep my status as a legal student all the time. But eventually I discovered that I'm in the humanities, that's my field. And I began to write for the college newspaper. And in my last year of college, I took a poetry workshop. And that was that. That was at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. So my first 10 years were all in the South, Mississippi, Louisiana, Tennessee. And so by the time I was 24 is when I finished college. I was ready to be a writer of some sort, and I'd already published some poems and so on. So a compressed version of it is somebody who's kind of inclined towards reading, towards the art, not knowing what they do, what to do, what to sort of explore. And by the time of, you know, 15 years in your country and 7, 8, 9, 10 years abroad, where you're, you know, you had to find yourself and know your stories and tell your stories and try to figure out how to move around in the world. All of that was, you know, where the arts came the place to express that. And poetry was the place to do that. And even then, a lot of the poems were persona poems or dramatic monologues, where already the awareness that this ability to act, to voice, to think, to contemplate feelings that one did not have necessarily in one's life, or experiences that one had not experienced, but one can try to imagine deeply. That was with me from then on. Like the third section of my first book, Ismailia Eclipse, has many multiple voices that are versions of me, but that are not me myself, as Walt Whitman says.
What were the, you mentioned just a moment ago wanting to read the books that you loved. What were those books?
One book that was not assigned that caused me to basically, you know, miss a midterm exam in architecture and late on a project in architecture was The Diary of Malcolm X. I stole to Alex Haley, or the autobiography. Another was a great book that's not mentioned a lot. It's called The Road to Mecca by Muhammad Assad. These two books particularly, I just said, you know, the hell with the exam. I'm just going to sit there and read them. And there were others, but these two are the main culprits. My failed career in architecture is due to Alex Haley's excellent writing.
Well, the architecture world's loss is surely poetry's gain.
Well, I hope so. Architecture hasn't called me back.
What other American writers had influence on you?
Well, I think later on, once I began to really want to write, I think Whitman became a real occupation. In poetry, the four greats who all, you know, really held me were not American. They were all translated poets, and it sort of makes sense. Kavafi, Konstantin Kavafi from Greece, Nazım Hikmet from Turkey, García Lorca, probably the first poet that I really leapt into. So this is somebody from the Eastern Mediterranean, the North Central Mediterranean, the Western Mediterranean. So they were people who were, and then a different kind of poet, but further out is I think one book that was very important to me, but Vallejo, Cesar Vallejo from Peru, was a poet that I really loved a great deal. So those, some of the early poems were from there. I can't quite remember what the first book of American poetry that held me, but it was an anthology by A. Poulin, anthology of contemporary American poetry. And that's that I read through, that I read poets like Philip Levine and Adrian Rich and John Logan and Sylvia Plath and Robert Lowell and Robert Hayden. All of them were poets whose work that I sort of imbibed. When I went through that anthology, I saw many of my thefts staring at me. So you took that one from this one, and that one from that one, and this one from this one. So a kind of canon of mid-century or, you know, second half of the 20th century American poetry was Eliot too. I mean, Prufrock. I mean, I remember memorizing Prufrock early on and just having that kind of music in my head. So that's a lot of names, but I would say that my first years were reading the translated poetry. Charles Simic was one of the poets who just sat me down and made me, you know, his stories is inspiring for all of us immigrants, also coming to the US at the age of 15 and, you know, becoming a major American poet, just an important American poet. So he was, you know, one of those poets that I read and paid attention to.
That's interesting that you gravitated towards the translated poetry, and you worked as a translator yourself. What is that like in terms of your approach to that work versus creating your own original work?
Well, I think, and I mentioned this in some of my writing, is that when I was reading Lorca, for example, in early on, I also one day stumbled on some at a ethnic store on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. I went to, I had a dinner. It was a complete solitary, alienated foreigner experience. Find your ethnic food, and then what else are you going to do? I went to this ethnic store, and they happened to have, alongside the cassettes and the canned beans from Egypt and Lebanon and so on, they had tiny little books supported by Mahmoud Darwish, who was the great Palestinian poet. He passed away in 2008. He was very, very, very popular, and the books were like, you know, pocket-sized books. Those books made it over to that shop, and some just they were thrown somewhere, and I picked up as many as I could, and that was the poetry that I didn't know it very well, but it was when I began to read it. So, you know, I know this voice, I know this poetry. I want something in English to capture this, because that would be my voice in a way, that the poems I've not been able to write. If I write a surrealist poem this way or that way, the symbols that I thought I would be wanting to write about, I was sort of at a loss, you know. Mentioning particular trees as opposed to others. Mahmoud Darwish, sort of in Arabic, oh, I want to know, mention that tree, and you don't know it. So in English, you don't know the tree you want to mention, but in your native language, maybe it's mentioned, and then you say, "Oh, okay, that's the tree. I need to find the English word for that tree to mention in the poem that I wanted to write." So in a way, translation was practice. First of all, it was very good poetry. So your challenge is to say, well, I know poetry, huh? A little bit. Maybe if I can make this very good poetry sound like good poetry in English, that's a good challenge. You know, it's a good exercise. Almost like you're playing piano, just like playing an instrument, figuring out your instrument. And with that, I think came this sense of the world that you could bring in. So translation was a way that allowed me, I can say this in English, or this can be smuggled into English. English allows this. And I had not seen many translations of Darwish before I began to translate him. And later on, I found out that a lot of it had been translated, but not that much. But it was my practicing of it was to legitimate the landscape, the voice, the sentiment. All of that is what translation has sort of has allowed. And I think it was a kind of marker. I mean, I remember like two poems that I wrote at that very on that very visit in New York that basically kind of, those are the poems, they were in my first book. Those are the poems that I worked on them for several years, but those are the poems that said, okay, I think I know what I'm going to write about. And so, you know, Lorca's Poet in New York, Mahmoud Darwish being translated, me saying, well, okay, I have a license to do this and a license to do this. That's where translation, what it did at the beginning. Later on, I think it was really a process of wanting to have, you know, bodies of work next to yours in some ways. I wanted to you know, again, it's like the excess of seeing, or maybe the excess of talking. Like, I talk too much, I might as well translate. So that was like, I could do a lot of poetry. Yeah, I can't force my imagination to write a lot of poetry, but maybe I'll give one side of the imagination rest and use the skills of writing proficiently, tightly, with some awareness and skill. Maybe I can bring that into these Arab poets who might not be read if I didn't render them in English. So it was the excess desire for poetry. Translation was, again, it was, I could translate when I remember my father was ill at some point and he was lying in his bed and I could sit and translate. When we moved to an apartment and he would rest in his room, I could translate. It was writing and poems and loving what you're producing to some extent, and you know, and being happy that you're producing poetry. But it didn't exert that sort of creativity, that anxiety that you have when you're writing your own poems. And you're filled with poetry in some ways. You know, your hand is moving. Sometimes you say, oh, "Let me stop translating. Let me write something." It's all in the playing. I'm at the piano as a musician, if you will, all the time. I'm playing Bach or Adonis or Saadi Youssef or whatever it is. And then, okay, but I think I have a moment for myself here. Let me write that. And it was all continuous, if you will.
When you're working in multiple languages, are there concepts or ideas that you find easier to express in one language versus another?
Well, I work only in Arabic and English, and I've reversed. Now I translate more to Arabic than I translate to English, and so sometimes it's so spontaneous that, well, okay, this is a concept. It's going to take me 3 words instead of 2 to say it, or maybe 3 words to give a feeling of what really happened, of what I think is actually being said, to give a feeling for it, than I would in English. That I would need a few more words in Arabic than in English. In English than in Arabic. Sometimes it's the other way around too. So it's so spontaneous that I don't think that there's anything that can stop any translation. Somebody was telling me about a joke about the United States sort of English, where in America you say horseback riding, and the British make fun of that. It's like horseback, what are you going to ride, the front of the horse, or who's going to ride? But then, is that the work of a translator? Is that like somebody translating this activity too much? So when you do these kinds of things, whether you add the word back or not to something that may be clear, it is just, you do it spontaneously. And if it makes sense, it sticks. So I guess some translations are very difficult. It's interesting. I find translating prose sometimes more difficult than poetry, maybe because it's more restrictive, or maybe in poetry I feel that I can have the greater license in some ways to be a poet. I'm not sure why prose is more difficult, or maybe just because poetry is more fun as a textual exercise. But at any rate, I don't really feel that there is anything that that can hinder, and I think it's in the effort. I was looking at a lot of translations recently of older Arabic poetry, and it does take sometimes, like a sentence of 6 words might take up to 10 words in English. Some people tell me that in Russian it's different, like 10 words in Russian can be rendered in 7 words or 7 syllables in English. But that's how you just need that maneuverability. But I don't think there's anything that hinders. We've been translating all of our existences, you know? I mean, if you look at how the English, how many accents are still very different in England. In America, we don't have that. But in England, they're like the way the Dorset sounds different from Yorkshire, from Wales, from Scotland, from Ireland. I mean, these people kept the way they're talking, but that's how different languages really are. And they were speaking the same language. So we either kind of find a middle accent that unifies us and we speak together, communicate. We're always translating. There isn't a way in which my language and yours are not different, even when we're speaking the same language. So translation is the most basic element of communication. And we're already trying to often express something that's not readily expressible. So we're translating. Even when we talk, we're translating. So there isn't anything that culturally from this place that another place cannot understand. There's easy to dismiss, but to say you cannot understand, I think gets to be a little bit on the it becomes politics. It doesn't become people wanting to know what they're saying to each other.
Yeah. I wanted to ask if you'd read to us a little bit from Fugitive Atlas.
So I'll read again. The book is all over the place, but I'll try to read maybe some of the more American poems, if you will. Here's a poem about a place. Maybe before that, I'll read a poem called Beatitudes, and it takes us from a creation story until a more environmental story, cultural story. And it's a conversation between a father and a daughter, child. Beatitudes. My child wants to know if the mountains really cowered. How do you know when a sea or a river is afraid? How do you know when the sky is thinking yes or no? And him, Adam, why did he say yes? Did he know that all the other creatures refused the burden, that he was God's last choice? It's one poem, but it's also scattered throughout the book. So, Beatitude 2. Did you really have a party the day the dictator died? And you had a cake decorated with all the flags? Did you think his death will fix everything? Why did we spend all that time over there? And all these people fleeing and fighting and drowning, what are they hoping for? Beatitude 3. She speaks to me in our language, in front of her friends, to share a secret, or cool and beaming to show off. I wonder how long it will last, this pride, this intimacy. Sometimes she puts her arm next to mine and tells me I have the lighter skin. Why are you doing this, I ask. But she doesn't point to the flag or say it's the way of the world. Instead, she tells me not to worry, that she is the most kid in her class, the least mature one, Baba. Not all kinds of wisdom console, I tell her. Then I begin to think of words she'll soon hear that can make her wish she wasn't who she is. Lead me to virtue, O love, through the smoke of despair. And the last section of this poem is 4. Let's walk through the woods, she tells me. Let's walk through the rocky shore at sunrise. Let's walk through the clover fields at noon. In the rainforest, she is silent, mesmerized. She'd never prayed, we never taught her. But she seemed to then, eyes alert with joy. She points to a chameleon the size of a beetle, teaches me the names of flowers and trees, insects we can eat if we're ever lost here. I'm teaching you how to entrust the world to me, she says. You don't have to live forever to shield me from it. And I'll read a slightly longer one, but I think it speaks to our moment, to our anxieties, perhaps. This is called, and it's an American poem, if you will. It jumps around a lot, but everything, if I jump to one stone, I'll come back to it. So don't worry. We're all, it makes the rounds and it comes back. After Charlottesville, for days after, this was always coming, muscles taut to the smell of first arrival, the scent of an old fire in the woods, pioneers, Naipaul called them, maddened and bearing torches, a primitive born of civilization itself, a friend who once tended to Jefferson's foxgloves comes to mind, as you watch the stream movie to see the great actor express. What is the Arabic word for déjà vu? A dream released from restrictive facts, a murderer's face of indifference, the mind desperate to see things anew. You want a picture, the obsession with ancestry like a tangle of boughs. Ezra Pound's boughs, Mussolini hung upside down, the boughs covered with snow, dripping blood. You want footage of the cigarette break, soldiers smoking after the bodies had been hauled from the gas chamber. You look at your roof and wonder if it's time to install solar panels. Surely this is not your first encounter with this sort of thing. The immigration officer says, welcome home. Somehow it sounded like, welcome to my home. You remember the face of the butcher's assistant. You'd gone to the shop and picked a lamb from the pen in the back. Yes, the lamb, it was braying clover. And in 15 minutes, what do you call an animal's body after it's slaughtered and skinned? Strange there isn't a word in English for that, considering the innards, heart, lung, and liver in a plastic bag if you want them. And the blood is deja vu. And it's always Othello's, how in Aleppo once I took by the throat the circumcised dog and smote him thus. Desdemona lies sleeping in D.W. Griffith's arms. That's why these woods are no longer mere background. The scent of an old rapture and this enigma of a current buried in the spine. Of course he can say welcome, if it's his decision to let you in or not. But that's not the only difference between displace and replace. Their flags, emblazoned with axes and saws, announce a new kind of math, a new look for the old machinery droning to convince you it's your people who are sick in the head. As you drove away, you saw the man who transfigured the lamb. All cleaned up, hair combed, almost smell the soap on his hands, waiting for the microbus home. Maybe someday you'll go to college here, you tell your daughter as you enter Monticello. It's time for you to donate that old car to the radio station, she instructs you. Looking at photographs of lynchings, your eyes avert the martyr's unbearable holiness, and you gaze and gaze and gaze at the leering, familiar faces.
All right. Well, I wish we were all in a room together so that we could all applaud.
Thank you.
The way that we would, the way that we would if we could all be together. But thank you very much for being here with us tonight. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about your new book, which is Fugitive Atlas. But Helen Metalla, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you very much. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Tune in next week as we continue our Immigration Heritage Month celebrations with writer and professor Aaron Bobrow Strain, whose book, The Death and Life of Ida Hernandez, tells the true story of a Mexican teen mother journeying through the U.S. immigration system and the obstacles she faces. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.